It's a news buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. President-elect Donald Trump spoke last night in Des Moines. No loud chants of lock her up or CNN sucks, but some of the themes were familiar. His vow to build a wall on the U.S.-Mexico border, a promise to bring back American jobs shipped abroad, and to fight sweeping trade deals. Trump also praised Iowa Governor Terry Branstad, who Trump named this week to be the next U.S. ambassador to China.
He's going to do so great. With Terry on our side, I know we will succeed in bringing our jobs back. And I also know that China, who's been so tough and so competitive and, frankly, dealing with people that didn't get it. But I'll tell you what, we're going to have mutual respect. We're going to have mutual respect. And China's going to benefit, and we're going to benefit. And Terry's going to lead the way. So I just want to congratulate him.
President-elect Donald Trump speaking in Des Moines last night, praising Terry. The big Iowa news this week, of course, our governor, Terry Branstad, to become the next U.S. ambassador to China. Joining us now to talk about why Governor Branstad seems to be well-suited for this very important diplomatic position and how it may impact Iowa's ag sector, Amy Mayer, Iowa Public Radio's agriculture reporter, also with Harvest Public Media. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Ben.
So let's start off with the governor's background here, his strengths to be chosen as ambassador to China.
Well, as governor, just in the past 5 years, Terry Branstad has made four different trips to China. Those are partly goodwill missions, but also very much trade missions with the intent of increasing the amount of Iowa products that are and services that are sold in China. Also, Branstad has a history of a personal relationship with Chinese leaders, and so I think that's something that would definitely be appealing to a president-elect who's looking for an ambassador to China.
Mm-hmm. Now, U.S. farmers exported, I see, nearly $40 billion worth of ag goods to China and Mexico last year. So can you make that a little more focused on Iowa? How much of a connection in terms of ag exports do we have with China?
Well, last year in 2015, Iowa sold about $1.4 billion in agricultural products to China. And just for a little bit of context, that's an increase of more than 250% over the past decade. So in the past 10 years, the importance of the Chinese market for Iowa farmers and producers has been exponentially increased.
Mm-hmm. Perhaps that trend would continue with Governor Branstad being the U.S. ambassador to China. I suppose he would be there in any case to defend ag's interests, wouldn't he?
Exactly, and I think that's something that will give a lot of comfort to Iowa farmers and to American farmers and agricultural industry people in general. The Chinese have made a couple of moves in recent years that have demonstrated their interest in what's happening in U.S. agriculture. For example, a couple of years ago, a Chinese entity purchased Smithfield Foods, which was one of our country's biggest pork producers. Currently, the China National Chemical Company, known as ChemChina, is in conversations to buy Syngenta. Syngenta is a Swiss seed and agricultural chemical company, but it has a very important and very big presence here in the United States. So both of those moves have really been signals to the agriculture sector here in the U.S. that China is making moves, that China is an incredible opportunity, but also that it's got some interest in sort of bringing what other countries have to offer into their domestic sphere, not necessarily only importing the goods and services that we can produce.
Mm-hmm. We export a lot of pork, corn, beans to China. Is there any way to quantify how dependent they are on our agricultural goods here in Iowa?
We can certainly say that the Chinese have an increasing need for agricultural products that come from the United States. To really hash it down to specifically what the role of Iowa would be, I think that's getting a little fine. But for example, China is a major purchaser of ethanol. We know that ethanol production is a huge part of what our corn and, to some extent, soybean producers are contributing to. So far this year, China has imported $115 million of Iowa pork. Now, that's just a small amount of the overall pork that China is importing, both from other states and from other countries, but certainly it's a significant figure for Iowa pork producers.
Very good. Amy Mayer of Iowa Public Radio and Harvest Public Media, thanks for those insights.
You're welcome, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Other Donald Trump-related news here in Iowa. Earlier this week, organizers canceled plans to host an event later this month with a controversial journalist and activist at Iowa State University on the campus there. Joining us to tell us about that, Jeff Carice Carlson, higher education reporter with the Press Citizen in Iowa City, also with the Des Moines Register. Hi, Jeff.
Hello, Ben.
So tell us about the speaker and what he was coming to ISU to talk about.
Well, the speaker's name is Mayo Yiannopoulos. He is a senior editor with Breitbart News, and he had been invited to the Iowa State campus by a group called Iowa State Students for Trump. Although made up of students, that is not an officially recognized student organization. But a few months ago, they decided that they would bring in Milo as part of a last hurrah for their organization. They were assuming that Trump would win the election, which he went on to do. And they had worked out a time for him to come to the Iowa State campus in the Memorial Union on December 9th. Talking to their president, Austin Giles, he said he had worked out everything with the Iowa Memorial Union staff, had paid $1,000 to reserve the hall, and then in the last week of November got word from the Memorial Union event staff that they needed an additional $2,000 for security concerns.
Mm-hmm.
Because they are not an official student organization, all those additional costs had to be borne by them as if they were any other outside group. They tried to raise some money. Mayo Yiannopoulos tried to call on President Leith to waive such a security fee, but in the end, the decision had to be made not to mess up with the tour that the speaker was on, and they decided to cancel the event.
And remind us, what are the ideas that Mayo espouses that why would one need more security?
He is a controversial openly gay British journalist who has identified himself as a journalist of and a participant in the so-called alt-right movement as well.
Expand on that, because that's a fairly new term for us.
That is a fairly new term for that. And that's a term that came up a lot in the recent presidential election. And it is used by a number of groups primarily identify themselves as conservative. Some take themselves off the ideological spectrum and come from a different variety of places. News organizations are struggling with how to use the term, and the Associated Press, within the last weeks or so, came up with that they call that an ideology that's a mix of racism, white nationalism, and old-fashioned populism. When we use that term alt-right, it is one that we kind of are very clear as journalists that it's the movement themselves that are calling that. Yiannopoulos has identified himself as both a journalist of and a supporter of alt-right ideologies, and it's focused a lot in the critique of, specifically feminism, and to the point of being
anti-feminism.
Anti-feminism, and to the point of being called misogynistic. So Yiannopoulos has been banned from Twitter. There have been active protests against him at various other universities that have been that he's been visiting. And his own rider, as part of the contract for coming, specifies some additional security concerns.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Students for Trump say that they had given that rider and all that paperwork weeks before the event, and so they were surprised by the sudden tripling of the fee, basically, that were expected.
Mm-hmm. Are some seeing this as sort of a way to censor or silence a speaker coming to ISU?
Initially, they were intending to pay the additional security fee, but again, Austin Giles says that they raised some money eventually, but then they suddenly were worrying that this was some kind of backdoor attempt just to stop the event from happening as well. ISU officials have been very clear that this is standard practice for any outside group bringing in a speaker. And then the folks from Students for Trump have also pointed out that they recognize that if they were an official recognized student organization, the concerns about Milo probably would make it so they couldn't have brought him onto campus as part of an officially sanctioned university event.
Mm-hmm, because the university policies in terms of being inclusive and diverse and
exactly,
so forth.
Exactly.
Okay. Jeff Carice Carlson, higher education reporter with the Press Citizen and Des Moines Register. Thanks for coming in.
Well, thank you very much.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Gilchrist, Searley, Latham, Price, Mocker, Kamrick, Curris, Coob, Allen, Rood, and now we add Nook to that list of presidents of the University of Northern Iowa in Cedar Falls. This week, in a unanimous vote by the Iowa Board of Regents, Mark Nook was named the 11th president of the University of Northern Iowa. The native Iowan and astrophysicist returns to his home state from his current position as chancellor at Montana State University, Billings. Nook will assume his duties as UNI's president on February 1st. He has a 3-year contract, an annual salary of $357,000. And Mark Nook joins me now. Welcome and congratulations to you.
Thank you, Ben. It's good to be joining such a great university and UNI.
So about this position, what are you most looking forward to?
You know, right away, getting to know a lot of the students and the faculty and the people of the Cedar Valley, just settling in and returning to my home state, and then figuring out where this university needs to go next and meeting with a lot of people to help draft that future.
Mm-hmm. At this point, what do you see as the major challenges you'll be facing as president of UNI?
You know, one of the first ones is going to be getting our budget in place during this legislative season and getting that set, and then starting to look at what we can do with the enrollments, making sure they're solid because they're such an important part of our budget. More importantly, though, those enrollments are an important part of Iowa's future, making sure we've got students from Iowa into our universities and getting the degrees and the education they really need to be able to go out and lead in this state.
Mm-hmm. As you know, I'm sure now the new session of the legislature will present a unified government under Republicans in both houses as well as the governor's office. Do you expect any change of attitude, policy towards the three public universities, including UNI, under a unified Republican government here in Iowa?
I really don't. I haven't been following it all that closely over the last couple of years, you know, on the day-to-day basis. So I don't know the insides and outsides of what was going on before, you know, the last few months, really. But I've worked with both Democratic and Republican legislatures and in states where they had control of all of the houses in the governor's office. And, the important thing, I think, for the universities, the regents to do is to make sure we've got solid relationships there and help them understand our needs very, very well, so that as the budget comes in and they have to make the decisions that they need to make to put the budget together, we get the sort of funding that is appropriate given the revenues that the state has.
Mm-hmm. You have worked in higher education for a long time. I'm wondering if we can kind of zoom out and put UNI's challenges in context, the context of what higher education is going through in terms of change, and more specifically, change at public universities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, throughout higher ed right now, we're faced with a whole bunch of challenges that are out there. The student loan debt is a big one here at UNI. While the students that leave with debt, they're carrying a little bit less than the national average, which is good. Fortunately, you know, most of these students are Iowa people, and they have a real commitment to taking care of their debt, and we have a very low default rate, which says, you know, one, we're probably not too high in the debt they're carrying, but I'd like to see it come down too. You know, that's one of the big problems that's in the national context right now, conversation right now. You know, there is a conversation out there about the importance of higher ed, making sure everybody has an education beyond high school. There's some challenges to whether or not higher education is the right thing, especially a university degree, and I think we've got to here at UNI. Iowa State, U of I, we've got a real strong support in the state of Iowa for P PK to 12 education as well as higher education. So I'm not sure we've faced that same sort of criticism about the value of higher education, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't and have to keep talking about it and help everyone understand that higher education is something that the state really needs. We need more and more of our population to have a degree beyond high school, whether that's a college degree or a community college degree at the associate's level or a technical college degree or a university degree. The world is becoming more complicated, and we need the people with advanced training and advanced education to be able to solve the problems we're going to face as a civilization.
Mark Nook, all the finalists for the position that you were just awarded were white males. You are a white male. Some concern in the discussion about a lack of diversity. Talk about your commitment to diversity.
Yeah, I've always had a strong commitment to diversity and inclusion. When I say that, you know, diversity is really about the numbers. Having a population that's very similar to the population that's around us, and then inclusivity really means making sure that those students from underserved populations are as effective in obtaining an education as any other population in the university. I really started working on diversity issues going back to the early 90s. Helped co-found a task force on hate crimes at St. Cloud State when we had some racial issues pop up on that campus, and then wrote the university's racial issues curriculum and chaired the committee that wrote the diversity committee curriculum as well. So throughout my entire sort of academic career, in one way or another, I've been involved in working with diversity and supporting students of color, students of diverse backgrounds, and making sure they've got an equitable opportunity for an education.
If you just joined us, Mark Nook is with me, incoming University of Northern Iowa president. He'll be become president on February 1st of next year. Mark, you are a native Iowan. Tell us a little bit about your upbringing in Iowa, in the town of Holstein. This is east of Sioux City?
Just east of Sioux City, about 40 miles, 165 miles straight west of Cedar Falls on Highway 20. I was born in Estherville. But spent most of my youth in the town of Holstein. Dad was a hog buyer, feed and fertilizer salesman, and Mom was a junior high English teacher. We just really loved growing up in the small community of Holstein. There were 35 kids in my high school class. It was a town of about 1,500 when I was there. You build some really strong relationships. You understand what the word community really means in a town that size. People bend over backwards to help everybody else in town, and that's what I really appreciate about Iowa in general, but especially the small farming communities of this state.
Still have family here in Iowa? Was that one of the pulls that brought you back to the state?
Family is a pull that brings us back. We don't have family in the state anymore. My parents are now retired and living in Longmont, Colorado, for health reasons more than anything else, but I have... two of our three children live up in the Fox Valley of Wisconsin, so Appleton to Green Bay region, and our two granddaughters are up there. Then we have a third son that's down in Dallas, Texas area. Mm-hmm. But being a little closer, 1,000 miles closer to the kids and grandkids was a big draw. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And your wife, Cheryl, is she a Midwesterner?
She is. Cheryl grew up in Marshall, Minnesota, in the southwest corner of the state, about 75 miles north of Lake Okoboji. And we met there at Marshall, and she's definitely a Midwesterner, and she's very happy to be back in this part of the country and a little closer to family, too.
Mm-hmm. You are an astrophysicist by education, a bachelor's degree at Southwest Minnesota State University, a master's degree from Iowa State, and then a doctorate from the University of Wisconsin at Madison. I wonder, how much do you keep up on all the exciting discoveries in astrophysics these days?
I'm certainly not keeping up in the same way that I used to when I was actively teaching and doing some research. Try to read about things as I can, but I don't get into the research articles and things the way that I used to. I spend a little more time reading about higher education policy and theory and how we move universities forward.
But with your knowledge of astrophysics, do you have an area of astrophysics that excites you most? So many exciting discoveries at this time.
There are. You know, that's a great thing about astronomy is it's one of the two sciences that I say everybody from the age of 2 to 82 has questions about. You know, why is the sun red? Why is the sky blue? All of those just come flooding in. Then you start to hear about, you know, pulsating stars and galaxies and the expansion of the universe. And my real research area was in study of how stars, as they grow old and start to pulsate, produce dust and gas and studying that environment of stars as they age.
Mm. Well, you will become the 11th president of what used to be known as the Iowa State Teachers College. I wonder if we could end this conversation by having you tell us a little bit about a teacher who was especially important to you.
You know, there was one in college that really touched me. The Ted Rowe was my freshman calculus teacher, and I went into that classroom and sat kind of in the back on the first day, and he, after that class, I had a lot of trouble seeing. He called me up immediately after class. He says, "Mark, can you see the board?" And I said, "Well, kind of." He says, "Can you see the board?" I said, "Not really." And he said, "You know, from now on, you sit in the front room of right here in this seat or that seat, and if you're not there when I come in, I'm going to stop class and move you. So just take a seat in the front row." And so I started doing that, and, you know, it made a big difference. I could actually see the board and things of that sort. But it was a real commitment on his part to me as an individual, and it's always really stuck with me. After the end of that year, I had cornea transplants on one eye and could see much better, but I'd already figured out it worked a lot better to sit in the front row than in the back row.
Right. Well, there is a professor not just reading his notes. He's paying attention to what the students are soaking up, right?
That's exactly right. You know, he was watching all of us in that room to see how we were acting on the very first day, and certainly picked me out as somebody that was having trouble and said, you know, you can fix this if you'll sit in the front row where you're close enough to the board to see. And, you know, that's what I like about these comprehensive universities that are like you and I, and I think you and I is even special among them in their ability to really work with the individual student. I'll isolate some of those problems early on, see some talent that's there, and really help it grow and blossom.
All right, Mark Nook, thank you for this conversation. Congratulations once again, and all the best wishes as you become the 11th president of the University of Northern Iowa on February 1st. Mark Nook, thank you very much.
Thank you, Ben. I really appreciate it.
Coming up in just a moment after a short break, the Woodbury County Sheriff tells us about a new plan for dealing with drunken drivers. Davenport schools look to power up with solar. And an ISU scientist uses clamshells to build a record of the ocean's climate going back 1,000 years. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's your Friday News Buzz. Back in just a moment. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, now let's travel up to the Sioux City area in northwest Iowa to find out about a novel approach to treating people convicted of drunk driving. Next year, Woodbury County officials will again encourage Iowa legislators to allow a program that would let people convicted of drunk driving avoid jail if they pass regular sobriety tests as part of their recovery program. The Woodbury County Board of Supervisors is behind the move, as well as the county sheriff, Dave Drew. He joins us now. Sheriff Drew, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Ben. I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, explain how this program works.
Well, ideally, if we're going to take the South Dakota model, and the South Dakota model is if you are picked up for drunk driving, then as a condition of your bond, you will give a twice daily breath test at the local county sheriff's office. If you're a person who has a job where you travel out of state, or your job requires you to travel a distance away, they can put you on a ankle bracelet that will monitor if you're using alcohol or drugs, and then once a week you'd come and download that. And the other one, where you are able to come to the local sheriff's office, you would show up twice a day in the morning, sometime between 6 a.m. and 8 a.m., or often it's 5 p.m. to 7 p.m., and give a breath sample.
Mm-hmm. Why is this better than the traditional procedure, jailing someone in this situation?
Sure. Well, even beyond that, is what this does is now someone is monitoring the person that has been arrested. Right now, if you're arrested for drunk driving, you see the judge, and there's nothing that takes place till you, well, you could get a restricted license and until your court hearing. So no one's monitoring your behavior. And we feel the success in the program begins because we are monitoring them. We are monitoring them while they're out as a condition of bond because we don't want somebody to be killed in a drunk driving accident, because we understand that you've probably, before you ever got caught for drunk driving, have driven a numerous amount of times. And even if you have been convicted, you may slow down, but you will still eventually, days later, drive again. Mm-hmm. And we feel that now we have some, someone basically looking out on you. You yourself have to come in and do this. So we feel that that's a win-win, and that's something that isn't being done now.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned South Dakota as sort of a model that you're looking to. Do they have statistics that show this helps change behavior, limit recidivism?
Well, they had the program when it was implemented, and I believe it was around 2005, and those stats went for about a five-year period, according to the South Dakota Attorney General. I think it was 05 to 2010, and they had about a 12% decrease in drunk driving and 9% in domestic violence. And the nice part of this program is 24/7, is anything that has a nexus to alcohol or drugs, the judge can put that person on the 24/7 sobriety. So, for example, if a person has been involved in a domestic and there was alcohol involved, part of the condition of bond for that person could be that, hey, if you're going to have visitation with your children, you're going to come in and give a breath test twice a day. So you can use it in more ways than one, because often alcohol or drugs have a nexus to a lot of crime.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's the resistance to such an approach, the arguments that you find yourself having to counter?
I think that there's a misunderstanding maybe with the Mothers Against Drunk Driving community, and that they think maybe we're trying to be soft or an approach. And I think that we're trying to get the information out that, no, that isn't it. But here's what we feel, and I think statistics would show up, that incarcerating somebody for drunk driving doesn't really reduce the possibility of them going back and reoffending, because we know that we have repeat offender drunk drivers, because a lot of them are in prison, and that might be their fourth or fifth drunk driving and they end up in prison. So the ultimate goal is what 24/7 hopes to do, is that we're changing behavior. We're working on the person, and that person is giving a breath test twice a day for 90 days. Maybe that person, he or she, looks at themselves and thinks, you know what? Maybe I don't need to be so dependent on alcohol. Maybe I can be without it. And I think the success, South Dakota, Montana, and other states, they're starting to see that it's changing lives and changing behavior. Before, just putting someone in jail for an offense, we've been good at that for hundreds of years. But we need to try to figure out how to change behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that 24/7 is approach toward that.
Mm-hmm. Before we say goodbye, talk about cost. How does this compare, this new move compare? More costly, less costly for the county?
Oh, less costly, offender-based pricing. So incarcerating somebody in jail is roughly, we charge room and board of $55 a day. For a person to be on this program, there's no cost to the taxpayers. It's the offenders pay for it. It's $6 a day, $3 in the morning, $3 in the afternoon. I think you can actually make it $2 and each and $4 a day. So the cost of about a pack of cigarettes.
Mm-hmm.
And that allows that person to be out, maintain his employment, still be with his family versus being incarcerated. And we're not talking about somebody that has got in an accident that injured or killed somebody. That's a whole different approach. But we're talking about someone that has a drunk driving offense of maybe their blood alcohol is over a certain level, and this is a requirement for that person.
Mm-hmm. How do you gauge support for this in the legislature in the coming session? For instance, does it make a difference that this for this proposal that Iowa has now in the new session will have a unified government under the GOP?
Well, I mean, we had two from our area that worked very hard on it. One was a Republican and one was a Democrat, Jorgensen and Dawson, and tried to get it through. And it made it through somewhat, but then it seems a lot of these bills get all watered down, and then it didn't even look like what we initially wanted 24/7 to be as a condition of bond. I think it had a number of tag-alongs, and so that it just got watered down. I think sheriffs across Iowa were concerned, but we're trying to get out in front of it now, and I'm hoping to sit on the legislative committee for the Sheriff's Association and encourage this to continue to go forward, because I see it as a way to reduce the population in jail, but also change behavior, and that should be the ultimate goal of our whole criminal justice system.
Okay, thank you very much, Sheriff Dave Drew, Sheriff of Woodbury County, talking about why Iowa legislators should pass the so-called 24/7 sobriety program. Sheriff Drew, thank you so much.
Thank you, Ben. I appreciate it.
It's a Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, from the northwest part of the state there in Woodbury County, let's zip down to more or less the southeast corner where the Davenport Community School District continues on a path to more clean energy. Quad City Times reporter Deirdre Baker is with us. Hi, Deirdre.
Hi. How are you?
I'm doing fine. So, well, there's an aggressive plan underway or in the process to incorporate some more solar power. It's getting green lights so far. Tell us about it.
Yep. Well, the idea came to the district about a year ago, to the leadership area, where they wanted to see about, like many districts in Iowa, they're big school districts. They tend to lose students and have budget issues every single year. So this would be one way to help their overall budget and energy savings. What started out as a program for 2 to 3 buildings has grown to a program to include all 30 of the district's buildings. Davenport's about the third biggest school district in Iowa. So this has gotten a lot bigger, and the school board members are concerned about the impact, obviously, on students.
Mm-hmm.
The program, though, much bigger than they originally thought.
So does this mean the 30 buildings that constitute the Davenport Community School District will all have panels on their roofs, or will it be centralized? How will it look, or is it the planning not even that far yet?
Yeah, it is. Actually, there's a preliminary plan. There would be, most of them would be on the ground by the schools, or on the roof of the schools, depending on where the schools are. Like in older towns, some are in very residential areas, some are in outside of the edges of town, so there's room to put them on the ground. That's the exact site would come with the next step of the study, and board members are fairly supportive of looking exactly where would these places be, these arrays.
So you talked about cost savings. So there's a significant investment in the first place, isn't there? But then that savings, what the thought is, after years would be made up, and then you get into your savings.
Right. Well, right away, you probably know solar, saves money overall for anyone using it. They estimate $300,000 per year in savings right off the bat. After 20 years, that would be $1.9 million in estimated energy savings in the 21st year they'd own the system. This EPO Energy out of Columbus Junction would take on most of they'd construct the system. The district has very little to do in terms of constructing the system. EPO takes on that construction part of it, but then they also they get tax credits to offset their costs.
Mm-hmm. So where are we in the process? How close is this, the first panels being put up?
Yep, that's a good question. What's happened so far is in my first story, which ran in mid-November, talked about the process overall. Then I went to a planning meeting December 5th, which would have been Monday, and that's when they brought in the Mid-American Energy folks. The board members, to me, sound a little more hesitant, and they found out some other big school districts are looking at this. So they are trying very hard to weigh this intelligently. The next board meeting is Monday the 12th, and they are slated to vote on a letter of intent, which would put them on the record as moving forward, but not a binding resolution. The letter is EPO Energy needs it to get financing to do a next step from a bank. And the board seems kind of open to that, but they don't want to be bound to anything quite yet.
Mm-hmm. You said some board members hesitant. Do you know the reasons behind their hesitancy?
Yes. Our Julie DeSalvo is one who works for Mid-American Energy, and she's been very technical in her questions for the board, but she just points out she kind of likes the idea overall, but especially where are these going to be located so the kids aren't impacted and the neighborhoods are impacted to the least extent possible. And Jamie Snyder is another one who has also worried about where these arrays are going to be. They know they're going to be kind of nearby playground areas and school roofs. And we even had student school board members speak up with such concerns, noting the location seems to be very critical.
Mm-hmm. So if Davenport schools go ahead with this, the solar power installations on all 30 of its buildings, do you have any idea if that puts sort of the Davenport school system in the forefront here in the Midwest of solar power, renewable energy for the system?
Well, that's what the leadership believes. They would be by far the biggest customer using this type of thing. Now, solar arrays are all over the state, and especially farms and confined animal buildings. Farmers use them to a great extent. And this EPO Energy out of Columbus Junction, he works in the Midwest and has lots of, again, rural solar areas. So they say it works.
Okay.
Yeah.
We'll keep an eye on it, Deirdre. Deirdre Baker of the Quad City Times and telling us about how the Davenport Community School District, which includes not only Davenport but also Bluegrass, Buffalo, and Walcott, how they're really considering a big upswing in the amount of solar energy that will be used on the school district buildings. Deirdre, thank you very much.
Thanks, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, clamshells, well, they're great for making shiny buttons. I guess you could just ask anyone, just about anyone from Muscatine about that. It turns out, though, that an Iowa State scientist and several of his fellow scientists have been using clamshells for some very important research to help build a record of ocean climate, a record that stretches back 1,000 years. Alan Wanamaker is with us, Iowa State University Associate Professor of Geological and Atmospheric Sciences. Alan, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Ben. It's really great to be here.
Now, I understand you and your other researchers involved in this have been working for a long time. It's just out in a paper published online by the journal Nature Communications. You're one of several co-authors. Tell us, how far back does this project go?
It began in 2006 when... in fact, even before that, because there was a proposal written by a number of my colleagues to go for money in the European Union for a project called Climate of the Last Millennium. So this probably started a year before this, but it was funded. And in 2006, the group of scientists went up to the North Icelandic Shelf and collected these particular clams. And, you know, 10 years later, primary research paper has been published. So it's been three postdocs who worked on the project full-time and lots of collaborations along the way.
Okay, so tell us about these clams found in the North Icelandic Shelf. They're especially long-lived?
They are the longest-lived non-colonial animals. And what I mean by that is that it's a single individual animal. Corals can continue to propagate and live for thousands of years, but they're different. They're a colonial animal. So this is a single animal that lives as much as 500 years, and likely longer because we have such a small subset. It's likely that they can live for hundreds of years or more.
So there are clams up there that were alive or close to being alive when Columbus first came to the U.S.?
Absolutely. And when Shakespeare was penning some of his first plays, these clams were at the bottom of the seabed, just starting out as youngsters.
Okay. So you are analyzing, you've been collecting, sorting hundreds, thousands of these shells?
I mean, we have been working from one particular toe, and just to sort of explain how it's done is we drag behind what is known as a dredge, and we go along the seabed generally in the same exact seawater depth so we don't have issues with stratification in the ocean. And this one particular haul near Grimsay Island was so remarkable, we probably will never work through all the material. There were thousands of dead collected shells and several hundred live caught animals. And so we've been working through that material, and we've still only worked through a small subsection of it.
Okay, so tell us about the data you're finding in their shells. What can you tell?
Well, there's two things. Primarily, the most important aspect of is that inside of these shells, just like tree rings, there are annual increments that get laid down each year. And due to environmental forcing, sometimes you'll have a very narrow band or a larger band, and all of the shells tend to show that. So there's a unique barcode. So even though we had one clam that was exceptionally long, most of them were 1 to 200 years old, and then we had to take dead collected material and match into that unique barcode to extend it beyond any one individual's life. And when we've done that robustly, as they do with tree ring work, we then went in, and David Reynolds, the lead author of the study, sampled each individual year for oxygen isotope analysis, and we can relate that to seawater temperature and salinity and circulation dynamics.
Okay, so the picture you get, that's getting a little bit technical, but the picture you're getting over the last 1,000 years, does that match up with what you would expect to see? I guess this is in the oceans, not in the atmosphere, where we've been putting out greenhouse gases, huh?
Right, and so for the first time, we've been able to accurately compare the oceans without any error, so we can determine which part of the climate system changed first. And for the first 800 years of this record, the ocean was very active in driving climate in the atmosphere. It was either leading it or it was happening simultaneously. After the Industrial Revolution around 1800, the atmosphere seems to have taken control of the system. So greenhouse gas warming essentially has fundamentally changed the coupling between the ocean and the atmosphere, and that is one of the biggest findings of this study.
So when you say taking control of the system, you're talking about the whole planet's climate and weather.
Correct.
Okay, so before this, do we think this is the first time in the Earth's history that the oceans haven't been driving the climate?
Well, probably not. I mean, there's probably other times where they're closely coupled, but if there were large perturbations, let's say if there was large methane leaks from the oceans, which likely happened 50 million years ago during a neat time in Earth's history, the Paleo-Eocene thermal maximum, there was thought to be lots of methane released from the oceans. That would have then gone to the atmosphere, and the atmosphere again in a natural greenhouse would have probably had a larger control of the entire climate system.
Why is this paper? We have just over a minute left. Why is this paper and its findings important?
It really shows that humans have fundamentally altered the climate system during the Industrial Revolution through greenhouse gas emissions. And it shows also that the ocean is actively involved in regulating climate, and so the more that we know about that in the past, the better we're able to predict what's going to happen with increased changes in the climate system, including melting of Antarctica ice and Greenland ice.
This matches up with all the other climate science that's been done from other angles?
Absolutely. In fact, it looks a lot like the famous Michael Mann temperature reconstruction from the last 1,000 years, but it's from the oceans, and so the coherence is really tremendous.
So what's next with all these clamshells you and your colleagues have?
Well, we've now reported on one location in the ocean, so we can't say a whole lot. So we're working in the British Isles and Norway in the Gulf of Maine, and what we're trying to do is reconstruct the spatial signature through time.
That's very interesting. I'm sure we're going to want to check back with you.
That'd
Alan Wanamaker, Iowa State University Associate Professor of Geological and Atmospheric Sciences, thank you so much for sharing the findings of you and your colleagues. Just published online in the journal Nature Communications, and we appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Take care.
Okay, you too. Coming up on Monday, we go from the Earth to the space, to space with astrophysicists Bill Kurth and Jasper Halicus. That's on Monday's program. Actually out to Saturn to find out some research there that's including a University of Iowa instrument aboard a spacecraft. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Claire Roth, and Lindsay Moon. We had help today in Ames from Jason Burns. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us, and thanks, of course, for making it such a successful fund drive, reaching our goal.